This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. I know I say this every time politics gets in the way of this economy, but look, the economy doesn't just stop, you know? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today. This one is the 29th of September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The politics of this economy notwithstanding, tomorrow being the end of the federal government's fiscal year, and all y'all know what that means. Anyway, as I said, politics aside, the economics of this economy do require some discussion and analysis right now, so that is what we are going to do. Neil Richardson's at ADP. Heather Long is at the Washington Post. Hey, you two.
Hi, Kai.
So, Neela, we'll start with you on a cell phone, by the way, we should say, from a very wet and soggy New York tri-state area. Let's get the data out of the way first. PCE, the Fed's preferred measure of inflation, came out today. It looks pretty good. Core lower than expected.
It did
say good. So what do you think?
Well, there is some good news in that we saw that the PCE inflation measure that the Fed likes to look at the most actually came down quite a bit closer to their 2% target. That's 3.9%. So that's more progress, which is always good news when it comes to inflation. On the consumer side, though, we saw some things that are a little troubling. Consumer spending was a lot more modest in August. And that's, you know, something to look at, especially when adjusted for inflation. We see a pretty sluggish consumer over the last 3 months. So as you know, Kai, the consumer drives this economy and the consumer doesn't stop. We hope that their spending doesn't slow as well.
Well, so Heather, keep going on the consumer, right? Because the last thing on my list of questions to ask you guys today was consumers, though, exclamation point. With consumer confidence a little shaken, as we saw earlier this week, and with, even though it's coming down, prices are still higher than they were 2 years ago. What is your estimation of jeopardy, as it were?
Well, I think we've all been expecting a slowdown in consumer spending. The question is just, is it a gradual slowdown, or do you see something that really looks like falling off of a cliff? And there's a lot of concern right now if you're in a situation where those child care subsidies are going away and those costs could potentially go up. Of course, the student loan payments restarting, you know, maybe some federal workers aren't going to get paid for a while. And so you kind of start to go down the list right now, and there's a lot of squeeze factors that are going on in the economy. And I think there are some legitimate concerns about how much this really recedes. You know, at the moment, I don't think any panic buttons are going off, but the word seems to be discretionary spending is back in the discretionary sense of, do I really want to do this or not? It's belt tightening season.
Neela, we also learned this week that the economy, gross domestic product, is still growing, right? It's flat from quarter one. It was 2.1% annualized in quarter two. Do you think the consumer, I hate to use this word, but malaise, for all that it evokes, do you think that could affect things bigger picture going through the rest of the year?
Yes, I do.
All right.
The consumer, as we said, they're really the key to the growth in the second half of the year. In the second half of the year, you know, we've been pretty optimistic over the last couple of months about a soft landing being achieved and a lot of evidence around that. But if we go a few months back from that, economists were really worried about the second half of 2023, when we would reach really the tail end, the final end of all this government subsidy tied to the pandemic spending, and the excess savings also tied to the pandemic spending that really fed consumer spending. Well, that moment is now. We're here. Student loans are all due next month, in a couple of days, a few days actually. Yeah. And interest rates are higher on credit card debt. Personal savings rates are low. And so it does have some elements there of some soft consumer spending over the very important holiday season where a lot of retail sales are made.
So, Heather, playing that forward a little bit, you know, we are now going to be in an economy based on the latest readings we have from the Federal Reserve with interest, with the federal funds rate a little bit above 5%. You know, they may or may not raise again, but we're going to be here for a while. And I guess my question, given what Neela just said about worries about softening in the second half of this year and the remaining quarter, I guess, what does that look like?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. I think we really need better words than slow session, but I think
I hadn't heard that one. Let's definitely get a better one than that.
Yeah, going to end up with, and I keep trying to tell people, okay, sure, in the history books, if we have a soft landing, as Neela was outlining, that's going to look like a huge victory. But for those of us who actually have to live through the next few months, you know, let's say GDP growth is closer to 1%. Mm-hmm. That's going to feel like a really big change from GDP that we've had the past few years. And we're much more used to a 2% to 3% economy.
Right.
And so, you know, that's where I think we're heading. And you can already start to see it play out. I call it the wait and see mode. A lot of companies, if you ask them about their hiring, they've still got the position advertised, but they're not really quick to fill it. And it's, you know, it just feels that way. Like everybody's got their finger on the button. I really want to book that vacation, but I haven't hit the button yet. And everybody just sort of seems to be in this wait and see pattern. And that's why almost certainly we're going to have a slowdown, even if we avoid a recession.
Okay, last question. It's the same question to both of you. Neela, you get to go first. You are both very data savvy people, right? You read these things and you interpret the data for your colleagues and for the rest of us, and we appreciate that. I guess my question, Neela, is with the government about to shut down and with the Federal Reserve not having its official data, lots of high frequency data from private sources, my question is, what are you going to be looking at as the government shutdown continues, and how worried are you about the Fed flying blind right now?
Well, I think Heather really nailed it with this wanting to go forward, but ready to pause. And what puts people and companies into action is some certainty about the data showing the underlying strength of the economy. Absent of that, it's going to be very difficult to move forward. You know, you asked me what I'm looking at. Well, the ADP is putting out its national employment report next week. Right. I will be paying close attention to that. The high frequency with the private data, I think there's going to be a lot of economists really focused on private sector data that has a measurement of the economy in absence of the official government statistics. But I do think that absent indicators like CPI, like the unemployment rate, it's really going to be hard for most companies and individuals to get a good read of this economy.
Heather, quickly on the way out, what are your thoughts on what Neela said, but also that whole adding to the uncertainty thing, right? Because that's not what we need right now.
Exactly. I'll just say amen to everything Neela said. The other thing I'll be watching is, does Moody's downgrade the U.S. debt? We've already seen Fitch and S&P do it. They've been warning about the inability to do basic government functions.
Yep.
And we already know borrowing costs are soaring. And, you know, Moody's has warned that this could put them over the edge. And so I'll be watching that particularly closely. That will have long-lasting effects, even if we do get things going again in the next 2 weeks.
Heather Long at The Washington Post, Neela Richardson at ADP on a Friday. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Kai.
Thanks, Kai.
Have a nice weekend, everybody. On Wall Street today, Well, look, things were soggy in lower Manhattan, as you might have seen. Traders, though, were trading. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. As Republicans in the House of Representatives get set to shut down, among other things, the economic data gathering agencies of the federal government, as Neela and Heather and I were just talking about, the Commerce Department got out one last update today. Trade was the topic at hand, about which Commerce says the value of imports to this economy fell from July to August, down 1.2%. Exports, meanwhile, were up 2.2%. Not huge changes in either direction given the scale of this economy, but if you dig into the report a little bit deeper, as Marketplace's Justin Ho is wont to do, there is a line item that really stands out. Food exports are down almost 20% from the same time a year ago, about which two questions. Why? And what's that going to mean for American producers? Here's Justin.
Part of what's going on has to do with the amount of agricultural products we're sending overseas.
We have soybean exports down, corn exports are down, wheat exports are down.
That's Naomi Bloom, senior market advisor with Total Farm Marketing. Bloom says one reason is that over the last year, American grain crops have been kind of lackluster.
So far, everything is coming in where it rained, only average. Where it did not rain, it's coming in substantially lower, which obviously makes sense. If you don't have rain, it's hard to grow a crop.
Meanwhile, Bloom says American exporters face intense competition from Brazil, which has ramped up its own corn and soybean production. And that's caught the attention of a big export market.
China is buying larger amounts of corn and soybeans from Brazil rather than the United States.
It's not just export volumes that have fallen. Ag prices have come down, too, on a global level. Joe Glauber, senior research fellow at the International Food Policy Research Institute, says Russia's invasion of Ukraine had been pushing ag prices higher.
Certainly, the first half of 2022, we saw very, very high prices.
Glauber says Ukrainian wheat production is still down, but other countries have been producing more, including Russia and some South American countries. And that's relieved some of the pressure on global prices.
Over the last 12 months, we've seen, a decline, and we're back not just pre-war levels, but even lower.
That doesn't mean that American farmers' profits are taking a hit, says Alex Schaefer, a professor at Oklahoma State University. He says even though prices have come down from recent highs,
we've seen a reduction in a lot of those input costs. So fertilizer prices have really dropped this year.
And even though U.S. farmers are exporting less, Schaefer says they can still sell those same products here at home.
What we care about is not whether our product goes on the international market or the domestic market. What we care about is the price we're receiving here.
And more domestic food supply could help take the edge off food prices in the U.S. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Thousands of film and television writers went back to work this week. It's all over, but the actual voting on the proposed contract by members of the Writers Guild of America. The deal includes a first-of-its-kind clause for writers whose work on streaming platforms ends up drawing big crowds. Streamers like Netflix, Amazon, and Disney are going to be obligated to share some of their tightly held audience data with the union, quite possibly a first step to greater transparency in an industry that has not had a whole lot of it. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino reports.
Figuring out what content TV and movie audiences are watching used to be fairly straightforward. Count movie tickets sold at theaters, or track a representative sample of household TV sets, like Nielsen does.
With streaming, that's really a different model today.
Jennifer Kent conducts market research on consumer habits with consulting firm Parks Associates.
A lot of the audience isn't watching a same title at the same time. You might be watching a title on your mobile phone or on this smart TV, and then this other TV in your household is actually an Amazon Fire Stick.
She says that fragmentation has made it hard for a third party like Nielsen to accurately track streaming data. But it's given platforms unprecedented insight into their viewers, says Charles Schrieger, a business professor at NYU and former executive at HBO.
They know exactly who is watching their shows, how long they're watching it. They know whether or not you've watched the whole season. They know how many minutes you've watched at episode one. They know everything.
And platforms haven't been very forthcoming with that information, says independent analyst Paul Erickson.
For most streaming services, maintaining a certain level of opacity has been advantageous, as they can essentially manage the messaging and perception around the performance of their content portfolio.
Because it's not just writers or actors who might want to know how content performs.
There's a number of different stakeholders that have wanted greater transparency for a while.
Like shareholders and advertisers who are usually pretty nosy about seeing how their investments pay off. Of course, just because the WGA will get some data doesn't mean it will become public. They are under a non-disclosure agreement. But Erickson says the streaming platforms will be under increasing pressure to show their hands. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Coming up,
you have to enter a lottery and pray, essentially.
Good luck. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials off 158 today, almost a half percent, closed at 33,507, did the blue chips. The NASDAQ added 18 points, just over a tenth percent, 13,219. The S&P 500 subtracted 11 points, just over a quarter percent, finished at 42.88. Some of those streaming services Megan McCarty-Carino was just telling us about. Netflix added about a third of 1% today. Amazon pocketed 0.9%. Walt Disney grew 1.1%. Blue Apron added more than 130% today, 130%, after a food delivery startup agreed to buy the meal kit company for $103 million with an M dollars. That is down from a valuation of close to $1.9 billion with a B dollars just after Blue Apron's IPO in 2017. Let that sink in. Bonds were up, yield on the 10-year T-note down 4.57%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Ascensus, helping people dream bigger, aim higher, and save more with financial confidence. Unleash the power of your retirement savings plan with innovative technology that makes things easy, top-notch service from experts who care, and flexible solutions that can grow with you. For more than 40 years, Ascensus has been helping savers achieve their goals. We can help you achieve yours, too. Learn more at Ascensus.com. That's ASCENSUS.com.
And now a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry. Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns. Meaning, when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal, rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line, and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Ticketmaster announced the other day that fans lucky enough to score tickets for Olivia Rodrigo's upcoming tour are going to have to wait until 72 hours before their concert to actually get said tickets. It's another try to get ahead of the resale market for those oh-so-popular tours, which is kind of exploding. Taylor Swift tickets averaged about $3,800 on the secondary market. That's according to analysis by Pitchfork. Thing is, it kind of looks like scalpers hold all the advantages in actually getting those high-demand tickets. Jason Kebler is a reporter at 404 Media, and he had a story the other day aptly titled, "Why Scalpers Can Get Olivia Rodrigo Tickets and You Can't." Jason, thanks for coming on the program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Let's establish sort of a little ground truth here. If I want to go buy a concert ticket nowadays for Olivia Rodrigo or Taylor Swift or whoever, what do I have to do?
You have to enter a lottery and pray, essentially. You need to pre-register with Ticketmaster in order to be entered into something it calls Verified Fan. And then Ticketmaster uses an algorithm to essentially determine how big of a fan you are. Like if you've previously purchased tickets to Olivia Rodrigo or Taylor Swift, it might take that into account. If you live close to the venue, it might take that into account. And then you get a code and then you try to buy tickets along with millions of other people.
Right. Now, if I am right, and I pray, right? Exactly. Now, if I am an industrial scale scalper, what is my role there? What do I do if I want to get a bunch of tickets to sell?
If you are an industrial scale scalper, you buy hundreds or thousands of Ticketmaster accounts on these gray market websites that sell quote unquote legitimate verified Ticketmaster accounts. You enter that same lottery, but instead of entering it one time, you enter it thousands or tens of thousands of times. And then when the on sale comes around, you use a special browser that can cost $500 a month, and you open up.
I'm sorry, an internet browser that costs $500 a month?
An internet browser for ticket scalpers that costs $500 a month that allows them to enter what's known as the virtual waiting room thousands of times in order to basically have more bites at the apple than any fan ever would.
Explain the browser thing to me, because I go on, you know, Chrome or Safari or whatever it is, and I open a window and try to get Olivia Rodrigo tickets. That's great and fine. But these special scalper browsers do something different?
You can only open up one of these rooms in a Chrome browser. If you open a second tab on Chrome, Ticketmaster will detect that you're the same person because you're using the same IP address, you're using the same browser. So you only get one chance at that waiting room. These ticket scalping browsers are programmed so that each individual tab is detected as a separate browser. And so to Ticketmaster, it looks like thousands of people are all entering the waiting room, but in actuality, it's just one ticket scalper using this special browser that's designed to make it seem that way.
You know, it's funny the way, not funny, haha, but funny, sort of interesting, that the way scalping has evolved. I was talking about this with my boss the other day. It used to be you would go to an event, whatever it was, Dodger game, Taylor Swift, take your pick. And there would be people walking up and down outside the venue going, hey, I got two. Who needs some? Who needs it? Right. And now it's all online, faceless and industrialized.
It is, although I have seen people selling tickets outside of Dodgers games still, but they're getting it through these industrial processes.
It's a secondary market.
It is, yeah. I don't want to liken it to the drug trade, but it's something where there's like a big supplier who buys the tickets and then distributes them to sort of middlemen. Although, like you said, most of this activity is happening on StubHub. A lot of it is happening on Ticketmaster's own resale market, which is important. Ticketmaster kind of gets additional fees every time, both when it sells the ticket to a fan, but then also when a broker resells the ticket on its ticket marketplace, it's getting a fee a second time.
This might be a silly question, but for the scalpers who are buying these dummy Ticketmaster accounts, dummy's probably the wrong word because they actually work, right? But if you're buying hundreds, thousands of them, who's selling them?
So In our reporting, we have seen some of the accounts are hacked, like they're literally stolen. But then there's also people who just create Ticketmaster accounts with the intention of selling them later. And they do this process called aging, where you create a Ticketmaster account and then you hold on to it for a few years and you sell that quote unquote aged account years later, because some people have figured out that newly created accounts are less likely to win the lottery.
So there's forethought required, right? It's premeditated.
It's premeditated for sure. It's a huge industry. And so, yeah, they've basically figured out every restriction that Ticketmaster has and then have figured out a way to circumvent it.
Jason Kebler at 404 Media. Jason, thanks a lot. Fascinating story.
Thank you so much for having me.
The key shortage in this economy has been and continues to be workers. That's not news. What is news is the Biden administration's out with some ideas today on what states and municipalities might be able to do about it. There is money available, about $11 billion in American Rescue Plan funding. And one recommendation is investing in registered apprenticeships, which have been around since the 1930s, but are having, as they say, a moment. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes has more.
33-year-old Amber Risky was taking a break from paving a road in the Milwaukee area when I spoke to her this afternoon. She's an operating engineer apprentice, which means she is learning to use heavy equipment.
I'm physical. I'm moving all day. There's constant challenge through the day, and this is what I was meant to do.
And she likes the money. $30 an hour now, and that'll increase as she moves through the apprenticeship. It's more than just driving a paver. She learns other skills in the classroom.
Fixing small equipment or small engine, you know, hoisting and rigging, they want you to be well-rounded. So if you're out of work, they can put you in a different field.
Risky is one of more than 850,000 registered apprentices in the U.S., meaning they're in programs that meet standards set by the Department of Labor. That's nearly double the number from a decade ago. And the demand from employers for these workers is incredible. Mike Basham is VP of Education and Workforce Development for IEC Chesapeake, an electrician apprenticeship in Maryland.
With all the solar work, data centers, commercial buildings being built, there's just literally not enough electricians to do it. So we stay very busy.
Apprenticeships help keep the wheels of the economy moving, says Deputy Treasury Secretary Wally Adeyema. Sometimes, literally.
They help us deal with shortages in things like trucking that are critical to making sure that we can move goods around the country.
Adeyema says they also help move workers off the sidelines and into the labor force. In the Milwaukee area, Amber Risky is actually on her second registered apprenticeship. Her first was as a laborer. She likes proving wrong the people who told her women can't work in road construction.
It feels good. It feels really good.
And she says she's interested in mentoring future apprentices. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which the phrase you're looking for is demand destruction. Credit to the Wall Street Journal for rounding up the Wall Street analysis on this one. Those who follow crude closely are saying it may well be, barring a big supply shock, that $100 a barrel is about as high as oil prices are going to go. Goldman Sachs, which has long been saying prices are going to go higher, is now guessing $88 a barrel is where things are going to settle over the rest of the year. The U.S. benchmark West Texas Intermediate today, by the way, down 1% to just shy of $91 a barrel. Oh, demand destruction? When the price of something that's going up, crude or whatever, makes people use less of it. Demand destruction. All right, we're going. Here, though, is your moment of economic context, just because it needs saying. Government shutdowns, which are always about government spending, always wind up actually costing the government money. It's like nobody's paying attention. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Donna Tam is the executive editor. Neil Scarborough is the vice president and general manager. And I'm Kai Rizdal. Have a great weekend, everybody. We will see you on Monday, all right? This is APM.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.